Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Charles Fuchs, and to begin, he commented on several important papers in GI cancer presented at the annual ASCO meeting in Chicago in June, beginning with a study reporting on the use of anti-PD-1 antibodies in patients with MSI-high cancers.
A very general theme pervasive through ASCO this year was immunotherapy. And we've been desperate to get that involved in GI cancer. It has not been easy to get there. But I think this year's ASCO identified opportunities, limited opportunities, but nonetheless real in GI cancer. The first that got a lot of attention was a study that was led by colleagues at Johns Hopkins looking at the opportunity of using PD-1-directed therapy in colon cancer. As you know, most of the PD-1 and PD-L1 directed therapies have really failed to work in colorectal cancer. Their study showed that pembrolizumab had considerable efficacy in MSI-high stage 4 colon cancer patients with a response rate which is really unprecedented. It actually makes sense that would be the population who would respond, namely because MSI-high patients' tumors tend to have a brisk lymphocyte reaction in the tumor. So you would think they are more antigenetic, they have more neoantigens, and so the evidence really in a small population of patients shows efficacy. I think what's clear as we try to sort out what are the predictors of efficacy for PD-1, PD-L1-directed therapies, it clearly is hypermutation and the presence of neoantigens. And there was actually another abstract related to this in colon cancer that actually my group was involved with, looking at whether if you truly measure neoantigens beyond MSI, if you measure neoantigens, does that predict a tumor that's going to have a brisker lymphocyte reaction? And the data ultimately showed it did, that the presence of neoantigens predicts more lymphocytes in the tumor and a better outcome for those patients.
Can you go back through sort of what MSI is, the pathophysiology of it? You mentioned how it relates to immune therapy, but also how it relates, for example, to chemotherapy.
That's a great question, Neil. So microsatellite instability is a phenomenon that was discovered many years ago. When you think about the path by which an adenoma evolves to cancer, the principal path is through selected mutations in KRAS and P53 and other proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes that are very isolated. But it was clear that about 15% of colon cancers takes a different path, where in fact the tumors have these abundant mutations, often in repeated segments of DNA. So where there might be DNA code which is a series of four consecutive same nucleotides. And those regions are areas where the DNA replication machinery slips and makes mistakes more often. What was ultimately found out is that the people who have these hypermutations and these microsatellite or repeat mutations have is they have a silencing of the DNA mismatch repair machinery. What they actually do is they silence that gene principally through the evolution of the adenoma in cancer, through methylation of the promoter region of that gene. That's the most common way to get MSI. The other way is through Lynch syndrome, where people with Lynch syndrome actually inherited a mutated mismatch repair gene. Either way, that gets you MSI. What we've known for years is that patients who have MSI-high colon cancer have a better outcome. Stage for stage, they always do better, which is great. There have been evolving data to suggest that if you have stage 2 colon cancer and you're MSI positive, you shouldn't get adjuvant therapy, A, because you do very well, but B, because there's even evidence to suggest, though somewhat controversial, that they actually don't benefit from adjuvant therapy, that adjuvant 5-FU doesn't work in those patients. Now, I want to be clear, that data has been controversial. And when you look at other stages, like stage 3 colon cancer, if they're MSI high, they still benefit from 5-FU-directed therapy. But nonetheless, it's clearly a marker that predicts outcome, a better outcome. The other interesting thing about MSI high tumors that we've always known from our pathologists is that these tumors have a very considerable lymphocyte infiltration in the tumor. And in fact, very often, when the tumor is resected and the initial path comes out, the pathologist will pull you aside and say, hey, you know what, Charlie, this is going to be an MSI high positive tumor. And you'd say, well, how do you know that? Because there's an abundant lymphocytes, I guarantee you, wait and see. And they're often right, because there's such a tight correlation.
Any intuitive explanation? I mean, what do you say to your fellows to explain why there's a better outcome and less response to chemotherapy with these kinds of tumors?
Yeah, I think that what we may be learning, Neil, is that, in fact, this is a tumor because there's so many mutations, because there are all these neoantigens stimulating the immune system, that they're actually doing better because of our own innate immunity. A, so that they get a profound lymphocyte reaction to the tumor, and B, because they are now the ones that are responding to PD-1-directed therapy.
Now, what's the incidence of MSI-high in colorectal cancer, particularly with metastatic disease, which sort of weeds out a lot of the good prognosis people?
Great question. So overall, it's about 15%. That's all comers. But because these patients do so much better, they rarely become metastatic. And so if you actually look at the metastatic population, it's only about 2 to 4% have an MSI-high tumor. Well, I think if you look at the sort of pan-cancer genome analyses, you'll see that cancers that have hypermutations are better responding to immunotherapy. So melanoma, which is, as you know, the poster child for immunotherapy, they tend to be hypermutated and they tend to have great responses. What's interesting vis-a-vis GI is that a tumor that is often overlooked on the high mutation rate lists are upper GI cancers, esophageal and gastric cancer. And the other important thing we saw at ASCO this year, and frankly at GI ASCO earlier this year, was pembrolizumab working initially in gastric cancer. And at this ASCO meeting, we heard about a small study showing efficacy in esophageal cancer. Now, the rates of response are roughly about 20 to 30%, although clearly more than that have some measure of even minor response. But the response rates are not as high as other diseases. So in those diseases, esophagus and gastric, we clearly need to work out what are the biomarkers that inform the better responders.
So in these patients who've been treated with checkpoint inhibitors, specifically anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies, obviously, responses are being seen, colon, we were talking about gastric. Are these what's been seen with the other cancers, lung, melanoma, long-lasting when they occur?
Yes, it's really impressive. So if you look at the so-called spider plots that just track their response over time, they stay down there indefinitely. They really don't see a lot of progressive disease. So it's an interesting phenomenon, which is not everybody responds, but when they do, they're very durable responses.
What about testing? I guess typically it's an IHC test that's done in colon cancer. Is that adequate? Do you need next-gen sequencing? What about other tumors? Is this going to become a standard thing that you're going to look for in everybody with metastatic disease?
How you measure MSI can be one of two ways. The least common, but often historically used test, is a DNA assay that essentially assesses for frequency of mutations in 10 loci in the genome. That is, quote, the Bethesda criteria. It's a little more cumbersome because it's DNA-based and most pathology labs don't particularly like using it. The other is just doing immunohistochemistry for the mismatch repair genes, which are the genes that are lost and responsible for MSI, which is a very reasonable test and easier to do for pathologists.
So I guess technically it's been considered that evaluation of MSI is standard in colon cancer, including metastatic disease, but I'm not really sure whether people are doing it. For example, a patient who presents with metastatic disease, it seems like we quickly need an algorithm that says every single patient with metastatic colorectal cancer needs this test.
Completely agree. It is not part of the standard algorithm, Neil. It doesn't get done often enough. It has occasionally gotten done when people are trying to risk stratify stage 2 colon cancer patients to see whether they should get adjuvant therapy or not, but that's been very limited. The other consideration is people will do it when they're trying to decide, is this a familial colon cancer? Because as
right.
I mentioned, MSI predicts Lynch syndrome. But I agree with you. We need to do it routinely, because if there is a subset that's going to benefit from immunotherapy, we need to know up front.
And just to be clear, too, because there are a lot of people sending off next-gen sequencing, and they have a patient who's going through all approved therapies, they're still in good shape, they want to get in a trial. A lot of people send Foundation One. That will pick this up, correct?
Not necessarily. It will in the respect that you may see a litany of mutations across the tests, but if you really want to know, you should specifically send out MSI.
Interesting. Well, I guess, you know, really exciting to finally see. I mean, as you can imagine, it's been pretty wild and crazy in the rest of oncology in terms of checkpoint inhibitors. It's great that you all are now really in the game, for sure.
Absolutely.
Breast cancer is jumping in there. Seems like everything's got a little piece of this. The other thing from ASCO that really surprised me, axial growth, you say, did you see that paper? Because, you know, we've done a lot of work on breast cancer. On trastuzumab lapatinib and HER2 positive, and I was sure he was going to say gastric cancer, and he goes colon cancer.
Right.
HER2 positive colon cancer. And there was the paper, this Heracles trial, looking at that combination, which is used quite a bit in breast cancer. And these were patients with HER2 amplified disease, as in breast cancer, and not really the HER2 mutations we've heard a lot about recently in lung cancer. So what about this Heracles study?
Well, I think it really does speak to the fact that genomically characterizing these tumors in GI cancer is going to bear fruit. The problem is, as you know, is that HER2 positivity in colon, unlike breast, is very uncommon. You know, it's probably 5% or less in real practice. But it identifies a strategy that may work. And are we ready to do routine HER2 testing in colon cancer? I think that remains to be seen. But stay tuned, we may get there.
So I see that you had a paper looking at CALGB SWOG 80405 data, which of course we saw last year at the plenary session, looking at vitamin D status. How about that?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking about it. So as you recall, this CALGB trial basically looked at frontline chemotherapy with either cetuximab or bevacizumab and basically shows no difference. We also, as part of the study, asked if we could collect bloods from patients and measure their baseline level of 25 vitamin D, partly because we've had some observational work before this suggesting that vitamin D does have an impact on proliferation of colon cancer cells, and that also in smaller studies, patients with higher levels of 25 vitamin D do better. So we then proceeded with this really largest study now to date, over 1,000 people, where we had measured the 25 vitamin D levels, and it was clear individuals with higher levels did decidedly better in terms of both progression-free survival and overall survival. And on the basis of this and previous data, we're actually conducting a randomized phase 2 study, multicenter, across the U.S., in which patients are being, they're all receiving standard first-line FOLFOX and bevacizumab, and they're being randomized to either a relatively standard or perhaps low dose of vitamin D, 400 units a day, which is what's in a standard multivitamin, or 8,000 units a day for 2 weeks, followed by 4,000 units a day thereafter until progression. The study actually is supposed to enroll 120 patients. We've enrolled about 100 so far. So it should finish this year. And in fact, it's interesting because I know there are a lot of naysayers about our work about diet and lifestyle, but the patients really do clamor about this. And this study is enrolled very well.
Any tolerability issues with a higher dose of vitamin D?
Not at all. And it's interesting, even though there were many who speculated that too much vitamin D would be an issue, we've seen no issues of hypercalcemia or kidney stones or any other issues on this dose.
Now, of course, this is metastatic disease, and some of the work you've done in the past has been in the adjuvant setting. But sort of globally, what's the magnitude of the benefit that you think might be there, and how does it compare to some of the other things you've studied?
Yeah. Well, in our observational studies, we've seen people with higher levels as compared to low levels experiencing on the order of a 35 to 45% improvement in overall survival when their levels were higher. So comparable or even higher than what we've sometimes seen with any of our standard adjuvant therapies in stage 2 and 3 colon cancer. Now, those are observational studies, and clearly what are needed are intervention studies such as the one I mentioned earlier. But the data have been relatively compelling.
So hazard rate for survival of, like, sounds like 0.7 or lower.
Or even less.
Yeah, lower. as Tom Lynch would say about the palliative care study in lung cancer, if that was a drug, we'd give it, but it sort of is a drug, I guess. So are you doing it in your practice outside that trial?
I am. I mean, certainly I encourage people to participate in our randomized clinical trial, but outside of the clinical trial, I routinely measure 25 vitamin D because you will find that a substantial number of patients with colon cancer have low levels. In fact, in that CLGB trial that you asked about at ASCO, the median was below accepted standards. So low is all too common. So in fact, even as general practice, you'd want to supplement them. But as opposed to the Institute of Medicine, which says that 20 nanograms per milliliter is sufficient, our studies say that patients who get levels in the 30s, let's say 35, do better. And that's what I try to target for.
So let's go through a few of your cases, and I always get attracted to any case that begins 91-year-old male Holocaust survivor. We don't see that too often. Can you talk about this man?
Yeah, this was a real privilege, Neil. I mean, you know, we always have interesting discussions as practicing physicians, but this was, I have to admit, unique in my career. So I had the privilege a few months ago of meeting this gentleman, 91 years old, was a Holocaust survivor. And I have to tell you, just listening to that, Neil, I mean, this guy is my hero. I can't explain it any other way. It is profound to listen to his story. But he had presented a number of months earlier with fatigue, iron deficiency anemia, was ultimately found to have a non-obstructing lesion at the GE junction, which proved to be an adenocarcinoma. Regrettably, on CT, he had an 8-centimeter mass in his liver. He had also some bulky adenopathy. His ECOG performance status was actually pretty reasonable for a 91-year-old guy, I'd say about 1. And what was really interesting was that ultimately the HER2 testing came back as 3+ positive by immunohistochemistry. And ultimately, he actually lives in a retirement community, a suburb of Boston. And so it was clear that coming to Boston on a regular basis was going to be a problem. And much as I wanted to really enjoy talking to this guy, we ultimately arranged for him, you know, he ultimately is continuing with an outstanding oncologist closer to home, and we elected not to give him FOLFOX. And I'll be clear, my standard frontline therapy for HER2-positive gastric cancer is FOLFOX plus trastuzumab, and this guy might have tolerated it, but the oncologist and I sort of came up with deciding for now not to pursue Oxali and to give LV5-FU2 plus trastuzumab, and he's tolerating it great.
How long has he been on the treatment?
He's been on about 6 weeks, but best I can see, doing quite well on it.
What's his quality of life been like prior to this? Any comorbidities? And what was his sort of attitude when he kind of found out what was going on?
You know, he had an excellent performance status. He actually frequently lectures across the region about the Holocaust. And so a very active guy. And in fact, I think he had a very realistic view of what this was. We talked about what his prognosis was. He accepted it. I mean, you realize what this guy's been through earlier in his life. He never thought he was going to survive past the war. He thought it was, you know, unlikely, and he was probably right. So this is a guy who has been grateful for every day that he's had in his life. He loves his family. His family loves him. And, you know, as much as obviously he'd like to go on, he understands the reality of it, and he just wants to be able to enjoy every day he can.
So did you test for MSI or PD-1 in his tumor?
I didn't, although we actually have a study of a PD-1 antibody for gastric cancer. Regrettably, it's only in third line. So I've already had this conversation with his oncologist at a point where third line becomes relevant. And if he's still in reasonably good shape, we definitely want to offer that to him.
Now, what do we know about the correlation between MSI and response to PD-1 antibodies in gastric? Is that related at all?
Well, let me be clear. MSI occurs in 25% of gastric cancers. So that may explain why we're seeing responses. What we haven't done yet, Neil, is to say, are the people responding to PD-1 therapies, are they the MSI-high tumors? No one's actually done that yet. It needs to get done, but it hasn't been done.
So I kind of wonder, I mean, the paper that we talked about earlier, you know, which got published simultaneously in the New England Journal, looking at PD-1 antibodies in colon, you know, I wonder whether or not we're going to be in a situation soon, and maybe it would relate to a patient like this, where if you can document MSI high, maybe you'll get an antibody paid for?
I think you will. And frankly, once we work out the biomarkers in gastric cancer, I expect that we're going to be using PD-1 or PD-L1 directed therapies frontline. Of course we are.
Do you think that for a 91-year-old man that you don't want to give very strong therapy, or you already said you don't want to give Oxali, you could justify using this up front outside a trial setting?
I think a single agent PD-1 or PD-L1, typically well tolerated, as you know, I think would be fine for this gentleman. And as I say, if I could have made that trial available to him now of our PD-1 antibody, I would have done it gladly.
So I guess putting that aside, you still have a number of options that you might be thinking about in him in the future. I guess you might expect that maybe it would not be unlikely that he's going to do well on his first line therapy for a while, I guess. It just has the 5-FU there, but still with the trastuzumab. If he does either respond or stay stable for a while, and then as often occurs, you know, maybe has imaging progression, but still feels well, what would you be thinking about?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I've actually previously had a similar age gentleman that I cared for who was HER2 negative, but I also started initially on FU leucovorin. And when he did progress, but it was a modest progression, that is to say his ECOG performance status was still quite good, I then added Oxali to that guy's care. And he actually did quite well on FOLFOX. And after FOLFOX, I then actually gave that guy paclitaxel and ramucirumab. And even though he too was in his early 90s, he tolerated it quite well.
Yeah, and this issue of paclitaxel ramucirumab in HER2 positive disease kind of didn't exactly come up immediately when you first presented these data, and the data were presented both alone as well as with paclitaxel. But I guess those studies didn't really look at HER2 status.
Well, they didn't initially because when we started the REGARD study, Neil, we didn't know about TOGA and the role of HER2-directed therapy in gastric cancer. But actually at this year's ASCO, and I presented this data, we actually went back to the samples from the REGARD study, that is the single-agent ramucirumab versus placebo in second-line gastric, and much like you would expect, 15% of patients were HER2 positive. But the benefit of ramucirumab was not different in HER2 negative and HER2 positive. So whether you were HER2 positive or negative, you got the same benefit from using RAM.
And I guess that sort of ties into what I've been hearing before those data, which is people were considering ramucirumab and a taxane in a patient in a second-line situation with HER2-positive gastric cancer?
Despite the fact breast cancer shows, I think, compelling evidence of continuation of HER2-directed therapy, we don't know if that's true in gastric cancer. So I would suggest that, given the fact that trastuzumab is not approved in second-line, it is quite reasonable to move on to paclitaxel ramucirumab as second line. The other important thing to bear in mind is there's really very compelling preclinical data suggesting if you combine HER2-directed therapy with VEGF therapy, you can get synergy. And so what I think we'll be seeing soon are trials where we combine these agents.
Right. And I mean, I can tell you, even though a lot of investigators, I guess, at least GI investigators, are questioning whether or not to keep trastuzumab going in progression. I know what happens when I do a poll with general oncologists and say, what do you do? Because they're taking care of breast cancer. So right or wrong, they tend to apply the model. So for example, they might use ramucirumab, paclitaxel, and trastuzumab on progression. Do you do that?
I haven't combined the antibodies yet. We're hoping to get a study started soon to do that because it needs to be tested, much like it has in other diseases. I think it could be very encouraging.
So let's talk a little bit about pancreatic cancer, and maybe you can talk about your 52-year-old teacher.
Sure, yeah. Just a lovely guy, real salt-of-the-earth school teacher, loved by the community. Showed up in June of 2014 with left upper quadrant discomfort, and CT showed a mass in the head of the pancreas, liver mets, and as well basically an incidental but real lytic lesion in the left ileum. Ultimately, the biopsy of his liver showed adenocarcinoma consistent with pancreatic cancer, and he was actually started outside of a clinical trial because at the time he was initially started in conjunction with his treating oncologist elsewhere on nab-paclitaxel and GEM, which I'm totally supportive of, and then he then fully transferred his care to me. What's really great is we got the CAT scan at 2 months, had a really dramatic regression of disease, truly dramatic, in terms of all of his disease, his liver mets, his pancreas, as well as even, you know, we've seen now healing of the ileal lesion. And he's continued on that therapy in addition to a bisphosphonate, did fine, continued to have regression, sort of hit stable disease at about the six-month mark, where his C19 had normalized. And he was really starting to note neuropathy from the nab-paclitaxel. I stopped it. We then continued GEM. He's been doing great on the GEM. And ultimately, he asked me, could we back off a little bit? And so I now treat him every other week with gemcitabine. He's not keen to go off all therapy, Neil, and I don't blame him. So he sees me every other week for a single-agent gemcitabine. He's doing great.
What specifically did he have in terms of neuropathy, and has that improved at all since you stopped the NAB?
Yeah, he actually described it as almost, it was not unlike diabetic neuropathy. He really described it as almost painful neuropathy in his extremities. And it definitely has gotten better, but as you got to hear what I'm saying, the conversation has evolved where he's really wanted to see whether we could get away with less and less. So he's not keen to add it back and obviously convinced me to reduce the frequency of his gem alone.
Right. You mentioned he had lytic lesions in the bone. How often do you see that in pancreatic cancer?
Not commonly. And I have to tell you, Neil, when I first laid eyes on this guy last year, given the extent of disease, I was really pessimistic about what would happen, particularly when you're talking about disease metastasized in the bone. But he's had a phenomenal response.
How usual or unusual is it to see? Is this an extraordinarily unusual response or not uncommon to see this level of response?
Yeah, well, as you know, you definitely see response rates with gem-nab-paclitaxel that, you know, can approach 20 to 30%, which I know doesn't seem particularly high, but it's pancreatic cancer, and you're talking about really resist, rigorously defined response rates. So, yeah, there's no question this combination has benefit and patients are doing better on it than gemcitabine alone. We clearly want to do better, which is why, based on our earlier conversation, I think adding novel agents to gem-nab-paclitaxel is the logical next step.
So it's interesting that this younger patient, you know, 52 years old, got started on gem-nab. Again, we're always surveying people, and we put 52 years old. A lot of people say FOLFIRINOX. How do you approach the younger patient? You mentioned, I don't know, from the beginning he was a little concerned about side effects of therapy. But generally, how do you think through the decision between FOLFIRINOX and NAB-GEM?
Sure. Oftentimes, as you say, a 52-year-old good performance individual, I will frankly typically start on FOLFIRINOX just because of the data at hand. But I talk to them about the therapeutic options, including gem-nab-paclitaxel. It was clear he was very focused on toxicity concerns. And at the time when he first started, there was another oncologist who was great, who was involved in his care. And I think ultimately the decision to proceed with gem-nab-paclitaxel was initially initiated by his treating oncologist and the patient, where they just arrived at, let's pick something in the middle. I'm afraid to go anything more toxic. But the proof of the pudding is it was the right decision for him.
How do you approach second-line therapy in patients who start out with gem-nab and second-line therapy in people who start out with FOLFIRINOX?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because this guy is, he's such a healthy guy that you could imagine if you're ever going to give FOLFIRINOX as a second line, this might be the guy. The only hitch, I have to be honest, is I would really worry about the myelosuppression that this guy would experience after getting a year plus of chemotherapy and then receiving FOLFIRINOX. So I'll talk to him about FOLFIRINOX. My guess is it'll be more like FOLFOX.
So let's finish out talking about colorectal cancer and your 72-year-old man.
He's been principally cared for by another oncologist who's remote here. He actually has essentially relocated to Boston. So, and his care is, I think, was totally effective and appropriate. That is to say, a 72-year-old guy presented in 2010 with stage 3 colon cancer, was KRAS wild type, got standard 6 months of adjuvant FOLFOX, regrettably, just 3 months after finishing adjuvant therapy, presented with peritoneal disease, some abdominal discomfort, bloating, and then the CT showed nodules and stranding in his mesentery.
He had ascites?
He had some trace ascites, but not enough that he needed to get a paracentesis.
So it's more an imaging thing?
Precisely. Well, he complained of some discomfort. He had gotten the imaging study, and it was clear what he had. And his CEA was up at the time. He got FOLFIRI-BEV with actually an initially good response followed by stable disease for 3 years, 2011 to 14, and continued on that regimen through 2014.
Now he got the irinotecan for 3 years?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, he tolerates treatment quite well. And as I say, his oncologist locally was doing it, but he really didn't run into any problems and there was no need to modify the therapy. Ultimately, in mid-2014, the summer of 14, he progressed, and because he was KRAS wild type, he got switched to FOLFIRI-panitumumab, again, a very appropriate choice. He actually did okay. I mean, he had stable disease really until about April of 2015. So, you know, roughly maybe 8 months of stable disease. So not too bad, but ultimately came to me having relocated and clearly showing progression of his peritoneal disease as well as liver mets. And we talked about a number of things. We didn't really have a clinical trial that was going to be available to him at the time, though he was interested. And I spoke to him about regorafenib. And ultimately, I will tell you that I elected to start him at 80 milligrams a day. Now, to be clear, this was a guy who was reasonably good performance status and had historically tolerated therapy very well. But increasingly, I've been moving into an area of starting at 80, and if they really sail through, escalating as opposed to starting at 160.
So you mentioned that you thought about other alternatives, non-trial alternatives, I guess. What were you thinking about as an alternative to regorafenib? Did you think about doing next-gen sequencing on the tumor?
So we are actually doing it now. It takes about 6 or 8 weeks for that to come back, and so I don't have the results. I know he's KRAS wild type. So definitely interested in considering them for clinical trials. There's also down the road, my guess is TAS-102, which as you know is an alternative fluoropyrimidine that shows efficacy in refractory colon cancer. I think that will likely be an option for him if he progresses on regorafenib. And then, you know, to the extent that any of his genomics from next-gen sequencing indicate a target, we'll certainly move forward on that.
Do you have MSI on him?
He's microsatellite stable.
So you elected to start him at 80 milligrams of regorafenib. How did he do?
He's tolerated it quite well. He got a CT scan just recently, which shows stable disease, so that was encouraging. He was not keen to escalate to 120.
Were you?
Not really. And I certainly thought about it because he has tolerated well, but I think regorafenib has a real place in the paradigm of colorectal cancer therapy. It's just, you know, I wonder, oftentimes like sorafenib for HCC, I'm, you know, given half the dose routinely, and maybe this is where we need to arrive at with regorafenib.
So I'll tell you about a case that Eric Van Cutsem presented from his practice at a satellite we did at ASCO, and you tell me what you would do, I'll tell you what the audience said. He had a patient with metastatic disease, not that different than this one, and he started regorafenib at 120. And after, I don't know, I think about a month, patient was completely fine. This patient had no hand foot at all at 80, incidentally?
No.
So same thing with this patient at 120. And we asked the audience, would you increase the dose? And they pretty much said no, just like you just said. And actually, Eric increased the dose. And he went up to 160. And the patient actually had a response, which I know is very unusual. But I was curious about this issue of dose escalation. And also another thing he showed in the case that I never heard before was that he showed the CAT scans and there was sort of like a central necrosis in the pulmonary mets. Have you ever seen that?
Absolutely. It's a phenomenon very clearly seen with VEGF inhibitors in colon cancer. And oftentimes people are now wondering whether that should be incorporated into our response criteria, because I think it's real. And you would imagine that regorafenib, being an inhibitor of the VEGF receptor, could potentially achieve the same thing. So I think that's encouraging for Eric's patient.
And again, it sounds like you just started 80 and keep it there, even if they're doing well?
Well, I am planning on escalating. I will tell you, first and foremost, this guy told me he didn't want to do it, right? Now, I'm not going to lie to you, Neil. Was I anxious to start to 120? He's feeling good. And he doesn't want to do it, and I didn't want to press him on it. I think for a different patient, perhaps younger, who's seeking to be more aggressive, I will increase to 120. And certainly listening to your story about Eric's patient, I'm perhaps more motivated today to do it. But I don't want to press it on somebody who's not really interested in doing it.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, Eric's patient could have responded at 80. You know, we just don't have the data right now.
Right.
But I never expected that he would do that, but certainly he's had a lot of experience with it. You mentioned TAS 102, and although it's not available at this moment in the United States, you might imagine it might be. What do we know about it? And if it is approved, how are you thinking about using it, if at all?
Yeah, well, the data were very similar to the CORRECT study for regorafenib, but, you know, a similar patient population had failed all approved therapies and were randomized to TAS 102 or placebo, showed a 1.8-month improvement in median overall survival, which is sort of comparable to what the other agents, including regorafenib, demonstrate. So I wouldn't say that you could press anybody that TAS 102 is a better agent than regorafenib. It's certainly a different agent. It's an oral fluoropyrimidine-like compound. So, you know, in some respects, there may be an element of sequencing here where for the refractory patients, regorafenib and TAS 102 are going to be standard approved options for patients. And how one decides which to use first will probably be physician preference.
Where do you see these two agents heading, if anywhere? Are they just going to kind of stay in this situation? Are there thoughts about combining them with other things, using them early? You know, the usual questions.
Yeah. Well, I think that combining regorafenib with chemotherapy remains an open question, right? Because we know it has efficacy as a single agent, but could it be improved with chemotherapy? And then similarly for TAS 102, it's a fluoropyrimidine. Could it be a better partner for chemotherapy than 5-fluorouracil, or for that matter, capecitabine? That remains to be determined, and I would presume the folks developing TAS 102 will want to test that hypothesis.